Thanks, everyone, for sticking around for the final one of the final sessions here. I'm Nick Upton with Restaurant Finance Monitor. I'm joined here by Lisa Van Kersteren and Bowie Chung from Uber. And we're talking a lot about this food on demand, third-party delivery out in the space. It's one of the hottest topics out there. And I think we'll just start there. Would you like to introduce yourselves a little bit? Tell us about your roles and how you're approaching this exciting disruptive technology.
Sure. Hi, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. I think we're the only thing that stands between you and gambling, so hopefully you can last for the whole hour. I'm Lisa Van Kersteren. I'm the CEO of C-Level, and our mission is to help our clients see at the level of their customer. So this is a lot about the brand and a lot about representation, what actually happened in operational performance. We do mystery shopping, we do customer surveys, we do auditing, all in an attempt to bring together multiple data streams and help clients, again, see at the level of their customer. So thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being here. Bowie?
Yeah, hi, everybody. First off, Nick, thank you for having us here, and Lisa, thank you for carrying out the study. I had a chance to take a quick sneak peek at some of the results earlier this morning, and I think it's super fascinating. I'm a director of operations at Uber. I work on our Uber Eats business in the U.S. and Canada. I have a feeling that we may have crossed paths, some of you guys in the room and myself, in the past. But if not, looking forward to having a conversation with you guys today. Maybe just a quick minute on Uber and Uber Eats and this business venture. So Uber, we're a technology company at our core. We're a mission-driven company, and a couple of years ago, we thought that with all the changes that are going on in industry, but in technology in particular, especially in the logistics space, we saw an opportunity to make a difference helping food be more accessible, be more available. We like to call it making food delivery effortless for anybody, everywhere. And so we're a mission-driven company, and that's how we think about it. We launched the Uber Eats business 2 years ago in Toronto. That was our first city. Today we're in 88 cities in the U.S. and Canada. Expect that to be over 100 before the end of the year. We partner with over 42,000 restaurants, and we are learning like crazy. Like I said, we're a technology company, but we care deeply about our partners. And one of the most fascinating parts of the journey for me personally, but I know I speak on behalf of the rest of the team, is getting to know your business and finding new and interesting ways that we can partner and experiment together and that we can help define what the future of food service looks like. So that's what gets me really excited. I had an opportunity to sit down a couple of sessions earlier today, and I know this is the finance and development conference, and so it's important to get into the financial details, and we can do that. What actually startled me a little bit was I thought, at least on the topic of food delivery, we'd have more conversation about the customer experience and how these new channels are impacting how people interact with food, because it's something that we're just seeing so much around how behaviors are changing. And we want to partner with all of you guys to service how consumers want to experience food. And I think there's some really interesting things happening there. Mm-hmm. The study gets right to the heart of it. And so I'm looking forward to the conversation, everyone.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And like Bowie said, we're kind of all learning this at the same time. Uber's learning how to tap into these markets, and we're all learning how to work with Uber and the other various sources out there. Lisa, can you walk us through how you put together some of this amazing data?
Yeah, sure. And this is important. There are a couple of distinctions I want to make so that everybody understands the flow of the data and the sources of the data. The fact that it's an unexplored territory is actually what made this kind of fun. We do a lot of work in the restaurant space, and so we went out to our restaurant clients and said, hey, guys, what's the big topic these days? And 100% of them said food on demand, third-party delivery services. Do we do it? How do we do it? Who are the players? How do we make the decision? And so that's what was the inspiration for the study. The first part of the study, there's a two-pronged approach. The first part of the study was a consumer study, where we went out to about 1,800 consumers, general population, that was research. I just geeked out for a second. General population, and we said, hey, what do you guys... What's important to you when you're ordering food? Ease of app, how quickly the food's going to arrive, what the courteousness of the driver, hot food hot, that type of thing. And we, from that, we developed a set of drivers for the second part of the study, which is really the key part of the study for us, and that is when we sent out mystery shoppers. And we used 1,400 mystery shoppers to then measure all of the attributes of performance based on what consumers said was important to them. And then those end up being weighted at the end. Say, hey, number one thing is be on time, for instance. Number three thing, food hot. So then we take a look at how each of the different services performed in those categories. And now we have a bit of a report card that we can use to start making decisions. And we've heard, actually, over the last couple days, I've been in all of the third-party delivery service sessions, probably not a big surprise because I'm super curious. And I've heard over and over again that it's just a black box. Nobody has these metrics. Nobody knows what it is to look for. Nobody is really clear on exactly how to measure it. But we've taken a good gander at that, and we have some interesting pieces of information to share. Again, let me just come back to the key point, is that the first set of data, and there's some slides in the first set of data, are what consumers are looking for. And the second set of data is how the companies performed against those key points. And so I'll point them out as we go along so you don't have to remember too much of that, but that is an important distinction. And so just a quick overview, we measured Uber Eats, Postmates, Grubhub, and DoorDash, sort of the four biggest that we found people were interested in, and we went to five cities, posted Atlanta, Boston, Dallas, Los Angeles, and Chicago.
Yeah, and we'll get to some of the markets and the various metrics that we saw in a little bit. But I think the big question that a lot of operators want to hear about is why are people ordering? There's a whole lot of answers. The number one is people just didn't want to leave the house. It's pretty simple. 13% said weather in the consumer survey. 12% said fast delivery. But there's so many other reasons. Don't want to pick up the children and bring them along. Too drunk. And that's probably a very popular one here in Vegas. Convenience is an obvious one. Busy, everyone's busier. Everyone wants to get their food easier. One respondent just said dog. Yeah. I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah,
but
it's one of my personal favorites,
yeah,
dog.
Yeah, so whether he owns a dog or is a dog, I'm not sure. But regardless, there is a lot of reasons to be ordering. Bowie, I think this is a good chance for you to like talk about what your consumers are saying. Why do you have any insight on why people are ordering, or is it just a matter of getting it to them regardless?
Yeah, for sure it's something that we think about because it's obviously the customer experience that we're talking about here. By the way, my favorite quote from the pages is general laziness as the reason why I order food.
Some very honest people there. Very yeah.
I mean, here's what we're seeing. Here's what makes this such a tricky question to answer. Like, why did you order? All the data I've ever seen on this topic leaves me convinced that food is it's something that we experience in such a diverse set of ways. And no two people experience it the same way. And when we eat, everybody in this room, the different moments when we interact with food, there's actually such a long tail of moments for each of us individually. So I'll share a few examples that were not intuitive to us at the start when we kicked off this business, but turned out to be really important for the consumer and therefore important for our business as well. One is late night ordering. So Uber, we happen to operate a driver network that is a 24/7 network. We've got hundreds of thousands of drivers in the U.S. that are on the road all the time. And so we're able to offer delivery services when they traditionally weren't available. And really quickly, as we spun up this business, we saw a spike in demand late at night. We're talking about midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., and you guys can imagine, who might be ordering at the time. But that, there's an audience there, and that's meaningful for new customer acquisition. We've also been experimenting with our partners to try different menus or expand their store hour offering in order to serve that customer base, because it's something that's new to the industry. And so we're learning, just like our partners are learning. But to me, that speaks to the diversity of ways that that people experience food. Late night's never going to be your entire business, but I think it's one of the many use cases that we need to, collectively learn how to solve in the long run.
Yeah, especially with all the competition out there in the restaurant space, finding these new day parts to really take advantage of is so hugely important for operators, and this is one way to tap into those. Now we've got some of the delivery times. On average, Uber is out in the lead, followed by Postmates and DoorDash here, but and then Grubhub is a little behind there. Lisa, what did you see here? We talked a little earlier about you know, how people approach the timing.
Yeah, it appears, and this is sort of a derived conclusion, not something that's stated, but it appears as though there's some different strategies going on as far as delivery time. There are some that seem to estimate high and deliver in a much shorter period of time, and there are others that their goal is to estimate at exactly about the time they think. Of course, consumers are going to give you a bit of a grace period. Mm-hmm. And the reverse is true as well. What's interesting here is that in the consumer survey in the upper right-hand corner, we asked the question, how long are you willing to wait? Mm-hmm. And more than half said up to 45 minutes. And so then, again, we went back and we measured how long they actually did wait. And this was bumped up against what was estimated. And it was also, we captured exactly how long it took, but then in addition to that, whether that was early, on time, or late. And it's interesting.
I'm
not going to jump ahead then.
No. We can jump ahead there. Okay. But it was really fascinating how people zeroed in on that. And let's go back to the order times very briefly, or the delivery times. I imagine that's a metric you look at very closely. How do you maintain that advantage? And I guess what role is the fleet of vehicles out everywhere, how does that play into effect here?
Yeah, of course. And of course, it's a topic that we think about a lot. And by the way, I didn't see the data prior to this morning, but it's kind of fun to come in first on the speed metric. We hope to come first because we're Uber, and speed is something that we think a lot about. So first, the way that we think about it, this again ties to how we think about the customer experience generally. By the way, we started off in the food space with a very narrow offering, a lunchtime-only business with a subset of options that were available for delivery in 10 minutes or less. And one of the things that we learned really quickly is that when you offer really fast options or different price points, you know, that in that model you have no choice but to be very experimental in an intentional way with your different types of menu offerings. There is just an appetite for choice more than anything else. And to me, when I look at the different averages on the page, you know, I look past it and see it as a distribution. And I know that they're, by offering food delivery in some cases in 15 minutes or less, with some cuisines that's possible. You know, you can make a curry in 3 minutes if that's what you do, but you couldn't do the same thing for a pad thai. But making that curry available for pickup in 3 minutes and if you're Uber, hopefully folks have tried Uber, you can generally get a car in about 5 minutes. That means if you're a restaurant, we can get you a car in about 5 minutes. That means if you're a consumer and you live a 7-minute drive away from a restaurant, we can get you that curry in under 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Opening up use cases like that, I think, is doing really interesting things for the user experience. And so that's what this page says to me. It's a journey that all the players on this page are on together. I like to think of it as, you know, we're all in school. These are our classmates. Our partners are a big part of the experimentation as well. But, you know, that's what the delivery time says to me. It says more choice. And if these are coming down over time, it means we're succeeding in our mission.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And, yeah, Lisa, we jumped ahead a little bit there. But tell us about what the consumers are saying about getting the order on time and what that does to their restaurant experience and their intent to return.
Yeah, so there's a lot of interesting points around this, actually. Mm-hmm. The first is, there was a question that we asked, if X goes wrong, Y goes wrong, Z goes wrong, and we had a chart, who would you blame? So that's very important. It's very important to both the delivery services as well as the restaurants, because they want to understand how it is that the consumer is thinking, so that you can then kind of try to lock down the logistics around what you feel you're responsible for, what they feel you're responsible for, because, again, it all comes back to the consumer's experience. So you may think you're not responsible for getting the food there on time. You may feel like, you know, once it gets out the door, it's out of your hands. But that's the part that gets a little bit scary, because it's then out of your hands. And so your brand is now being delivered to somebody's living room instead of in your dining room, where you can control that experience. So that piece of it is very scary for a restaurant operator. And it generated a lot of the kind of the questions around, was the driver professional? Did they drop off your food? Did they kind of leave it on the doorstep and run? Did they thank you? Those types of things. Because once you're extending your brand into their living room, then they feel like they have a say over that, and as is appropriate. Mm-hmm. But one of the findings that I thought was kind of interesting, and it's not on the slide, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway, just because I found it intriguing, and that is that from a restaurant operator's perspective, 70% of the people that we surveyed, and this is in the consumer survey, said that they would be willing to try a restaurant by delivery, that they would not necessarily be willing to try in person. And I thought that opens up a huge opportunity potentially to reach customers that you might not otherwise reach. So that's kind of on the upside of a delivery service. I thought that was pretty intriguing. I would imagine you probably already looked at some of the data that tells you that.
For sure. Yeah. There's so many great points you just made, and I'm restraining myself because I know we've got other topics to cover in the presentation. But we're going to talk a little bit about like what are the new use cases and a little bit about brand, because I think that's a really important consideration, how consumers experience the good and the bad of delivery and what that means for the way we need to partner in order to deliver a good service. So to me, when I reacted to this slide, by the way, I think it's a super fascinating slide. It says a lot of things. There's two things that jump out to me. I think in a mature version of this world, because like I said, we're all in class and we're learning this together, the green segment, that should be very large, and that should be the vast majority of the bar. I think there's a little bit of a philosophical exploration, or maybe it's consumer experience exploration, like what are we aiming for when we target delivery times. I'll share a little bit about Uber's approach. Not because it's necessarily the best approach, but I think it's interesting how we think about it. We want to maximize the green bar, and Lisa called out to me when we were chatting outside that you guys have the biggest red box. I'm like, I know, we've got the biggest red box. We've also got the smallest yellow box. That's because what we aim for is the most accurate prediction time possible. And if you're shooting for accuracy, what will probably happen is if you're going to overshoot sometimes, you know, you're also going to undershoot sometimes, and that should look kind of balanced because there are these things that impact your delivery times that you can't totally control, like the weather or the traffic or parking or other things. Our goal is to get the green segment as large as possible. It's also a balance, and here's what's non-trivial, and here's what we need to collectively figure out as we become great operators in this space. And the reason I say we is let's dig into a couple of things that explain the red. Like, why does that happen? If there's so many cars on the road, then why does Uber Eats sometimes deliver late? Sometimes it's because we provide for all of our restaurant partners the ability to, on a Friday evening, when your kitchen is jam-packed, everybody's super busy, and there's a pad thai that you would typically have ready for pickup in 20 minutes, we'll give you the option to say, it's really busy in my kitchen. I'm going to really damage my in-store experience if I skip the line with this pad thai. And so I'm going to push out the time for pickup by 40 minutes. And our logistics network is smart enough to say, well, okay, if you need 40 minutes, we're going to give you the time. Who are we to tell you how to run your kitchen? But that means that the courier is going to pick up on time. And by the way, it's not going to be perfect for the eater experience because, we told them together that that food was going to arrive in 30 minutes. So that's not a perfect eater experience, but it's a balance. And I think we need to constantly work together on the right technology and also the right operational processes that are going to be the right balance for how we run our businesses, but at the same time provide a great experience.
Well, thanks. And next is the total cost of the food. Generally, consumers are willing to pay more. They're willing to pay more for delivery in general, and that generally ticks up just because of the way they're exploring the menu and picking what they want. And they have plenty of time. They're not pressured by anyone behind them in the restaurant. But I think that's a pretty straightforward slide. We won't waste too much time on that one. The total cost of the food order, I think, was really interesting. And this doesn't have the delivery fee, which I think is really important. Overall, I think Uber's is right at about $5. Same with Postmates. Grubhub and DoorDash are a little less. And those all fall well in line with what the consumers say is within the right size, you know, delivery fee. As you can see on the slide, the consumers say $8 is getting too expensive, $6 is getting expensive, but they'll still use the service. $3.60 is kind of what zeroed in on a great deal, and anything below $2 is questionable. They're wondering who this guy is that's making $1.75 an order, and what the heck is he bringing me? And I think that's all really fascinating. How I imagine that's a big thing you look at, Bowie, and Uber's been called kind of the economist's dream for showing this transparent demand curve out there. How do you right size that delivery fee, and are there, you know, some surges out there? I guess how do you approach that?
Yeah, I'll start with the delivery fee because it's an important part of our business, our business mm-hmm. model. And I'll just say this, you know, our experience in the U.S. and Canada is a delivery fee of about $5 to the consumer is about what's needed to make the economics work for all sides. You know, $5, you did the research yourself, and we've done this research as well, is in the range where a lot of consumers are comfortable paying that fee for delivery. It also seems to make the economics work for us and the economics work for our restaurant partners. The total cost of the order, I think that's a really fascinating statistic, and it's another statistic where I think the distribution is as important, if not more important, than the average, because I'm not sure what the average tells me, but I do know this. I know that depending on the occasion and depending on the diversity of your partner network, if you're a provider, that's going to really impact the size of the average order. I'll tell you that after we partnered with McDonald's in the U.S., you know, at least a little bit, our basket size came down. And by the way, we don't worry about that because we know that we're a mission-driven company, and making eating well effortless for everybody means providing on the platform the things that they want to eat. In store, obviously, McDonald's is going to be a lower basket size than others, so it's what you would expect. By the way, their basket size on delivery is higher than it is in store, but you know, you guys get my point. So for me, total cost of the order, I think the real message here is we need to think about selection on the platform over time and how we make delivery a viable option for all the food makers in the world, not just the ones that produce, you know, more expensive food. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, another thing to add to this, but I'm not sure if everyone is in the opening session with, but Andrew Charles from Cohen has some research saying that generally these orders are going to be double what they are on premise, which is fascinating and kind of goes with just what you were saying there. Lisa, anything to add here? Were you surprised at all about what the consumers were saying around how much they would pay or where the tickets actually came in?
No, actually, I have to say I wasn't. That may not be a good soundbite for you. Sorry, we weren't very surprised about that.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, even the delivery fees we anticipated would fall out just about how they have fallen out, mm-hmm. because it's pretty consistent across the delivery services what they're for the most part what they're charging and percentages. It can vary, but to Bowie's point, an average is just an average. So you know, maybe higher in some industries, some food categories. It may be driven also in part, for instance, by how far the person had to travel to deliver the food. Some of the averages, we just want to take into account that there are averages, and there's drill down that can become more and more and more relevant depending on which criteria, which filters you pick.
Yeah, and can you speak a little to that? I thought that was something I wanted to learn about. But were these generally single-person orders in the survey, or are they families, or who's doing the ordering through your mystery shopping?
Yeah, okay. So we have a network of about 650,000 people, and so we go out to them and we say, here's what we want you to do, here's the task we want you to complete, here's the survey you're going to need to fill out, here are the things you're going to have to be aware of, you're going to need timing, you're going to need to make sure that the delivery person looked professional. You have to be in a place where you can see their car. We mandated that they had to live in a house so that we didn't have to deal with timing differences between getting through apartment gates and things like that. So you control for everything you can control for. And Now I lost the original point of the question.
Oh, no. Is it generally single person?
Yeah. Sorry, I was getting there.
No,
we mandated that they ordered a hot entree and a cold drink. And after that, they could order anything else that they wanted. And the reason for that was we wanted to see the packaging. We're also interested in packaging because we're interested in the temperature of the food. Was the hot food still hot when it got there? Mm-hmm. Was the cold drink or cold side still cold? And then from there, we drilled down into what kind of packaging was it. Was it styrofoam? Was it foil? So we mandated a certain part of it, a minimum, so that the results were comparable. And then the rest we left up to them to decide, which is how it generally falls out.
By the way, if there's anybody out here who feels like they have solved delivery packaging, I would love to. I would love to talk to you after this session.
He'll be available to offer you a job after the session here. Yeah. And one thing I thought was really interesting was the results vary, and sometimes in surprising ways across markets, and especially as many of these companies are working on penetrating these markets. Uber, I know, is growing very fast, as is Grubhub and many others. There's a lot of big differences here. How do you, Bowie, come into a market, and how do you, how do you emphasize speed and all the things that you try to do when you come into a new market?
Yeah, so we have this saying at Uber, and the saying is celebrate cities. And the reason we say that is because we're a technology company. A lot of the software development is, of course, done in our case, San Francisco and in New York City. But the experience is a very local experience. So that's what jumps out to me on the page. What you're seeing in terms of, I think it's delivery times and basket sizes, explains some of that. But what are the characteristics of a city that really impact the delivery experience that we see? The demographics, for sure, is a part of it. I'll say Florida, for example, is a state for us where we see a lot of multi entree orders. We see a lot of chains, but other differences that really matter: traffic patterns, the density of a city, which impacts how fast your delivery times are. Whether it's a city with a lot of condos and apartments, because that means very different things for what the drop-off experience feels like for a courier. And by the way, just like you guys are our customers and people who eat food are our customers, our couriers are too. And we think really, really hard about that. And so all of these things really impact the delivery experience in the city. And you see that come through in things like delivery times and some of the economics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was very surprised by some of the results here. Given all the talk of Los Angeles traffic, I was very surprised that they were under 40 minutes. But Lisa, were there any surprises for you in as far as these markets go?
So again, I'm going to say no, even though it's again not a good soundbite. But the fact is, and we've heard it mentioned a couple of times over the past couple of days in the different sessions, that there are regional players, and some of the regional players are regional and successful in that region because that's where they're focused. And then they might pick up and move to another market and expand to another market. And you get that expansion slowly if they're being, careful about what they're doing. So regional strengths is not unusual in any company, in fact, particularly in a B2C type of environment where you're delivering on the ground, because you have to take into account regionalisms, localisms, cityisms, townisms even. All of that makes a difference. So it's not at all surprising that it plays out a little bit differently in the different cities.
Cool. And yeah, now I think this is one of the most fascinating slides for restaurant operators. It's a bit of an eye chart, but they are available in the app and make those available online. But the bulk of these are not replacing on-premise visits. Mostly it's people, they're at home, they don't want to cook, they don't want to go out, So it's almost completely incremental. And the one thing that I thought here was fascinating is, it's mostly home cooking. That's I think I just mentioned that. But and then there's some different results across the various platforms. Amazon, for example, that one does happen to replace restaurant visits. Who knows what that says about the cult of Amazon there and the kind of people involved? But it's an interesting little part there. But yeah. Bowie, do you see this as mostly incremental?
So that's what we hear from our partners. stand here this morning quoted a Cohen report where their research estimated that 80% of delivery orders are incremental. And we see we consistently hear 70-80% mm-hmm. range from folks that we partner with. But by the way, Lisa and I were just joking about general laziness, what was on the slide earlier today. There is so we spend a lot of time thinking about demographics and how people generally, like in food and also outside of food, interact with technology. And I saw this page and I thought about an article I read actually a couple months ago. It was in The Atlantic, and it was about how teenagers and 20-somethings interact with their world today, with their friends, their social networks. And if you're a young person, on average in America, you go out less. You no longer want to get your driver's license when you're 16. It's a chore. It's not a privilege, which is super fascinating. It wasn't that way when I grew up. And the vast majority of your interactions with your friends are over the phone. You're not going out to the movie theater anymore with your friends. You're not meeting up at the mall. Instead, your friends are coming over and you're watching Netflix. And the way people are socializing obviously ties to how people interact and experience food. And I think that's a big part of what we're seeing here.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, anything to add there about the different services? Any insight into why Amazon people don't like restaurants?
No, I'm not entirely sure about why Amazon people don't like restaurants. But mm-hmm. Just to clarify, this is from the consumer study. Yep. This is not from the mystery shopping study. So this is the 1,800 general population. Why did you order? What meal occasion did this replace? Speaking anecdotally, I would have guessed it's to replace cooking at home because I've been a long time frequent flyer of any ordering service that exists. So it wasn't a huge surprise to find out that cooking at home was the primary one, but the gap between that and the next one
take
down
that from a restaurant, yeah.
Right, was mm-hmm. a little bit surprising that it was that substantially higher that it replaced cooking at home. So, you know, one of the primary questions is this going to cannibalize my in-store sales? Because then you also give up the ability to upsell for drinks, you give up the ability to upsell promotions and desserts and things like that. So it's kind of a big give. And so the primary question for a lot of people a year ago, maybe less so now, was do I even want to do this? Do I want to get into delivering food as well as bringing people in? I think it's become a little bit more clear that that's the way most things are going. And yes, there are some things that aren't going to travel really well. A rare steak's not going to be great delivered to a doorstep, you know, 30 minutes later. But among most food groups, it's happening. And the good news is it's an incremental sale. Mm-hmm. Now the question is just who's the right partner and what do we need to control for to make sure that that experience is what we want it to be?
Yeah. Got another bit of an eye chart here, but what happens when things go wrong? I think this is on all operators' minds. Who do they actually blame for any issues around missing napkins, incorrect orders, missing forks, all that stuff that really seems to annoy people when a delivery does come? The good thing is the majority of services don't have any issues. But the bad for restaurant operators is that that largest yellow chunk there is the restaurant. They believe the restaurant is at fault for things like missing packaging, poor order correctness, and everything like that, which is obviously distressing as all these brands hand off their own brand to a delivery driver. But how do you approach that, and how do you ensure order correctness and all these various things that people really care about?
Yeah. So let me, I'm going to answer the question and talk about quality. The one thing I want to say first is just reacting to the data, because it's a really important point, and this is actually one of the most common questions I get when I talk to our partners. Like when something goes wrong, who does a consumer blame? And I think that the data sums it up quite well. For me, how I think about it is at home, my wife and I, so we order a lot of stuff from Amazon, like a lot. We order our toilet paper from like a lot from Amazon. And when an Amazon item shows up late or not at all or damaged, Because I don't want to speak for folks in the room, because I think there's a diversity in how people think about these things. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you for sure that when something does not show up, my wife is angry at Amazon. She is angry at UPS. She is angry at me. And she's angry at my parents for bringing me into this world I placed the Amazon order. You know, when food doesn't arrive, people are not going to feel good about that. You go through the academic exercise of who should be responsible from a brand perspective. I think it's an academic exercise. I think the future here and the important exercise is the only way the percentage of deliveries that don't go well, you know, comes down over time is we invest and we experiment and we make progress like together as an industry. I don't even mean just Uber, but I'm speaking about everybody that operates in this space. So I think that's a really important point when we think about brand, because we got to work on that together, but also operationally what this means. Okay, things that we do to manage quality. So this is really important. This is the biggest theme for us in the U.S. and Canada in 2018, not because we think our quality is bad on a relative basis, but we think in the industry it's a really big opportunity, a really big opportunity. I'll share a little bit about our approach, because what that's going to reveal is why do things sometimes not go as planned? It's never just one thing. I shared an example earlier about, you know, Friday evening, the really busy restaurant kitchen that leads to a late order. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, it is such a long tail of one-off issues that range from parking, that range from weather, that range from, by the way, Uber Eats is relatively new in a small town with a population of 150,000, and there aren't that many Uber drivers yet. And so at 2 a.m. most nights, it's okay, but you know, on Saturday night, my buddy threw a party, and so there aren't a lot of Uber drivers out on the road, and that impacts the experience. So there's a really long tail, and systematically, we've got an operations team that is very focused on issue by issue, coming up with an approach so that we can mitigate that. I'll share one example of something that we found to be a cause of delivery woes in one case. And we started to take real action there. Your guys' restaurants, the delivery, your opening hours don't stay the same for all time. And when you've got a large network of managers and operators, sometimes they just forget to change the delivery time. Or maybe there's an event going on in the city, like a concert, Lollapalooza in Chicago, where we know demand for Uber is going to be really high. In those situations, it's going to take longer for a car to arrive, and that's something we got to prepare for. What we're starting to get better at is making sure our field teams – remember, we're 2 years into this business, and so anything that is seasonal in this business, in most of our markets in the U.S. and Canada, we've seen it once – and in our oldest cities, we've seen it twice. But we're learning from those experiences and getting better at knowing ahead of time if we're going to come into a tough supply situation, meaning, you know, maybe there aren't going to be so many cars on the road, and also working with our partners to share reminders of, hey, if you're going to change your opening hours, let us know, because that's going to impact the consumer experience, which is the consumer experience for the both of us. Mm-hmm.
You're very nice about that and not calling out the restaurant operators, but I think this slide really says that operators have to ensure order correctness and they have to have a process in place when they are sending out orders. Otherwise, it's not Bowie and Uber that are getting the blame. It's really the restaurant. Lisa, any insight here about, you know, the demographics?
I do. I was hoping you would ask, because now I have a yes.
Great.
I actually, what I thought was interesting about this is that 50% of the time, on average, something went wrong. I actually thought that was very interesting, because it's pretty high. That's a pretty high number for something to go wrong during that process. Now, it's clear that consumers don't always know who to blame or who's responsible, and clearly it could be either one. You know, we can all come up with a scenario where it could be either one or the other, but the key, again, is a partnership, and let's work backwards to figure out what did go wrong so that we can fix that particular logistical issue. But that 50% of the time something went wrong was surprisingly high to me. Yeah, compared to some of the other types of studies we do where it's a little bit more straightforward. And again, this was the consumer study, just to be clear. This is when we ask customers, have you ordered from an app within the past week? And yes, and did something go wrong? 50% of the time, something going wrong is a pretty high number, which says, you know, lots of opportunity, lots of low-hanging fruit there probably to work with.
Wonderful. And yeah, that's it for the data exclusively, but let's open it up for questions. There's mics coming around, so if you can just wait for the mic so we can make sure that everyone can hear.
Lisa, I'm curious, did you ask a similar question in the mystery shopper study, and did it support a similar error or problem rate in delivery?
So that's actually a really good question. Thanks for asking. I would have teed that up myself if I'd thought of it. We did, but we asked it in a different way. We didn't ask, you know, did something go wrong? We asked for the specific things that happened in a mystery shop just from a methodological perspective. It's very objective. We're not asking for their opinions. We're asking them to tell us what happened. So we'll ask them, what time did you place the order? What time did they say it would be there? And then what time did it get there? And we're not going to ask them how they feel about that because we're paying them to do a job. This is, again, is subjectivity versus objectivity. It's just the way the different types of studies are set up. So we did, and not nearly as many. It was not 50% of the time that something went wrong as far as an objective view of the process was concerned. Subjectively, it's clear that they thought in the consumer study about half the time things were going wrong. But when we asked specific questions about, you know, what time was the food hot, all the things that they said were important to them, surprisingly, most of the time, it all went well. So, you know, what that opens up is there's a lot of subjectivity. And sometimes that gap can be breached with customers by marketing and communication. Sometimes when customers feel a certain way, it doesn't mean you have to change what you're doing. It may just mean that you want to direct or redirect their attention to what it is they're looking at, as opposed to, yeah, it arrived in 25 minutes instead of 20, but 5-minute window. You know, if you had known 25, would you still have ordered? Yes. So kind of got to tease that out a bit.
Hi. One of the things I've always wanted to know is when someone goes to a delivery marketplace, what percentage of the people go to get a specific restaurant to have their food delivered versus going to one of the marketplaces and then deciding which restaurant to choose? Do you have any data on that?
We do, actually. I don't have it on one of these slides, but if you give me your card afterwards, I can send it to you. And what's really interesting, actually, just as a follow-up point to that, the question was worded more like, when you chose the app that you used, why did you choose it? Was it because of the restaurant? Was it because of the delivery time? But just as an extension of that, we asked then a follow-up question, which was, if the wait time was too long, and that's, of course, your estimation of what's too long, would you change the app that you're ordering from, or would you change the restaurant? 70% of them would change the restaurant, which is also a pretty impactful number, I think.
Yeah, I think that really speaks to the stickiness of a lot of these apps. Some people have said as much as 70% of people that are app users just will not get another app, and that's really fascinating, and so it really shows that when people get in and they stay.
Yeah, I have a question for Bowie. I'm an operator of 3 restaurants. I have all kinds of apps. But it's a cumbersome job for the cashier to be able to get to the order, get it to the kitchen. There's a lot of duplication involved. What are our delivery partners doing, or what is the direction we're going to be heading in? So it's seamless, POS integration, kitchen printing, some of the service that can make it easier, because we are already working. It has been done twice. You are getting the data, and we are getting the data, and then there are things missing because the data is input incorrectly. So to make it seamless and more precise, what is the next step?
Yeah. I think it's a great question, and let me start by saying I've seen the same challenge in the field, especially if you're in a city like San Francisco, where there are so many different platforms. You know, I've seen a countertop with with seven different tablets. And, you know, some restaurants, you know, might manage that more comfortably than others. But I think we would all agree that that's not the future of what the restaurant technology is going to look like. I don't know for sure what the future is going to look like. I got to believe it's something that's a little bit simpler. You know, I fast forward to 2020 is, you know, we talk about how do we think food service is going to look like in 2020. I think we're going to have to take steps towards integration with POS systems. By the way, I don't think that's just for the food delivery platforms. I think there's a lot of technology in a restaurant today that feels a little bit scattered, at least the operators that I talk to. So the industry is moving in that direction, I got to believe. I'd love to see Uber Eats play a role in helping to, you know, shepherd the movement in that direction in a good way, in a way that's good for the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if real tactically, you know, in the year 2017, I don't know if we're going to see a solution to a lot of different tablets. Here's what we do think about, though. We spend a lot of time in the field working with our operators and learning about the different workflows and different types of restaurants. And we're exploring ways that we can make the interface more intuitive and natural depending on the workflow of your restaurant. Because if you're a full-service restaurant compared to a quick service, just the way whether you're a host or whether you're not a host or whoever's operating the tablet, it varies. And so we appreciate that. And those are some of the things that we can control and start to make progress on in the meantime before, you know, the ecosystem converges.
What about live phone support?
Yeah, we have live phone support. Yeah. Yeah. It's okay. Really good question. So here's how we think about it. To be honest, I'll speak for Uber because I'm actually, I don't know how everybody else does it, but for our restaurant partners, we offer 24/7 phone support. So there's always an agent that you can talk to, who can look up what's going on in the restaurant and help explain a situation that, is confusing. Like maybe there's a sudden hailstorm or something like that. And you're like, what do I do? Nobody can drive. And there's also situations where, a well-intentioned staff might sometimes forget to include an item. And so how can we fix that and make it right by the customers? Customer service is there to support in those situations as well. What I think we can get better at is, I think offering live phone support is important. I think an even better experience is one where in tablet you can resolve a lot of things on your own, and you can do that in a natural and intuitive way. That's new for the industry. It's something that we're thinking about, though, and I'd love to see us make a lot of progress there.
And I'll add to that that there are some third-party providers that offer POS integration, and some of that is coming down market. There are some smaller POS providers that are adding this kind of functionality into the system, so you can get rid of a lot of those tablets that are sitting around.
Even kitchen printing, I mean, that's become seamless. That even if you don't even have to go integrate with POS, if you could conveniently get something printed in the kitchen, that saves us a lot of time.
Yeah, that's a big question out there, I think, right now, and something we're figuring out.
If so when the customer didn't get their pad thai, do you think that customer should call you or should call me?
I mean, what's important for, I presume that's a question for me.
yeah, I'm not going to be able to help with that, sorry.
For me, what I care most about is that the customer, the right procedures are in place so that we make it right by the customer. So I think less about what the customer should do. In my mind, this is, call it an opinion, in my mind it's a fact that in the future, customers are sometimes going to want to call Uber and sometimes going to call the restaurant. So today that's a fact. I think it's going to be a fact forever. But what does that imply for what we need to put in place to make it right by the customer? It means that our agents need to be able to very quickly understand what happened in the order. And so we build technology and products to empower them to have that conversation in a way that is customer friendly. We use the term customer obsessed. So at Uber, we would say have that conversation in a way that's customer obsessed. We also need to make sure that our restaurant partners who are getting the call in real time in a busy kitchen are able to quickly look up what happened with that particular order And again, have the tools in front of them so that they can take a customer-obsessed approach. So I think that's the answer. I think that's the way we need to approach it.
And I think we're out of time, but I believe Lisa and Boy are going to be here for a little while if you have any offline questions. But thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Thanks.